Hello and welcome to Zookeeping 101. This is the Zookeeper podcast where we take you behind the scenes talking to professionals in the industry about their stories, words of wisdom and journey so far to get to where they are today, really showing you what it takes to be a zookeeper. All views throughout the podcast shared are of those speaking alone and in no way reflect the collections they work for. So please come along for the journey, enjoy the ride and thank you for listening. Hello and welcome to Zookeeping 101. My name's James Dennis, I'm your presenter, and today we're talking all about leaders within the industry, and I'm really excited to introduce to you Lauren Lane. Welcome, Lauren, to the show.
Hello, James. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. I'm really excited to have you on. If you want to introduce to everyone officially who you are, where you come from and what title you hold.
Okay, I'm Lauren India Lane and I am currently working at Askham Bryan College and I'm the Animal Sciences, Conservation and Associated Enterprises Manager, which is a very long-winded title for that I basically look after the practical animal facilities, which include the wildlife park, which is a licensed zoo, and the dog school, which is a licensed kennels, and then our companion welfare department, which is our companion animals.
Amazing. Quite a varied role and a lot to that. And we'll dig into that, I'm sure, as we go through. But to get to there, we've learned very quickly throughout these episodes, there's always a journey. There's those stepping stones to get into where you are and becoming the person you are. Do you have them? Do you have those, that starting point to now?
Gosh, yes. I mean, it depends how far back you want to go, but I've always wanted to work with animals. It's been my absolute dream since I was tiny. Most pictures of me when I'm little is me mauling someone's animal that I didn't even ask about. But in school, I was very much told that I wasn't smart enough to be a vet, because I think when we were younger, you were pretty much told you could be a vet if you wanted to work with animals, and that was it. And I definitely wasn't smart enough for that. So I pretty much gave up on that dream in high school. And then I left school and I actually did an IT course and started working in an office. And I didn't stay very long. I left that because my mother said I should go and get some A-levels. So off I went to do some A-levels. And I picked something like psychology, biology, human physiology and health and something else. Anyway, it lasted 2 seconds, didn't like it, didn't stay. And then I started working in restaurants. And then I basically managed restaurants for a long time, including 5-star restaurants that sat in hotels. And then I moved around a little bit for these jobs. And then everything kind of fell apart one year where I lost my job and where I was living. And I ended up back in square one in kind of like the hometown that I grew up in. And I thought, well, if it's all gone to pot, then I'm going to make an effort to do something I actually want to do. And animals was always there, but I think was always, you shouldn't bother doing it because you were never smart enough to do it. So I was like, I know, I'd like to work with young people. And it's probably feeds into a bit about why I'm in the roles that I've been in my adult life as well. So I was like, right, I'm going to go and work with young people. And I thought I'm going to do some short courses that'll get me there. I do some volunteering and I did a counselling course where I learned how to basically counsel people. And in that, we had to do tons of role play where you just had to talk for 5 minutes so the other person could practice their counselling skills, as in like the correct nodding and the right, you know, like mirroring and all that type of stuff. I wish I did remember her name so I could thank her. But basically, the whole 5 minutes I would talk about animals repeatedly. And this woman in the middle of our role play kind of went, Lauren, can I stop you? And if animals is like your thing and what you really want to work with, I strongly suggest you do it now instead of when you're like 40, like me, when I'm trying to do it at this point in my life. And I thought, okay. So if I've spent all this time, everything couldn't get any lower. So I'm starting from scratch anyway. So let's go and do that. So I went back to college late on an animal management level 3. And I really loved it, despite supporting myself, having to pay rent and everything else and working part time. I would say during that course, I was absolutely in love with reptiles. And because I loved reptiles so much, the year 2 group had a talk by a reptile and raptor sanctuary that was localish to the college in the middle of the hills in North Wales. Because they knew that I loved reptiles, they said, hey, do you want to come over and see this talk, even though it wasn't for my class at all? So I sat there and I remember watching this guy talking about reptiles and where they'd come from and the neglect that they'd suffered. And I was just like, oh my God, I need to help. This is ridiculous. I can't believe how bad this is. Because I think you think of rescue and you think of dogs and cats and rabbits and horses and all sorts. They're the common adverts, I guess you see. And then I spoke to this guy after the talk and he said, yeah, you should come up and have a look. And maybe you had work experience to do. So I went up to visit them and I was absolutely compelled by everything that they were doing. I couldn't believe how bad it was. how much it cost to fix something and how difficult it was to, and where the core problems were with where the neglect started, and how, you know, you could buy a 16-foot Burmese python as a tiny baby, but no one would tell you that in the shop. And then you've got all these animals coming in. So I actually booked my work experience in five different places. I did like an exotic vet, I did the reptile sanctuary, I did a pet shop, I did a country park, I did a college thing. So I really had no idea where I wanted to be. And to be honest, zoos weren't even really on my radar at that point. And that rescue center, I did 2 weeks there initially, and then I couldn't stop. And I said, can I come back and kind of volunteer? And I kept coming back and coming back. And I genuinely think it's those people that started my whole career. They always say it's because we saw something in you. Like they said, I couldn't believe I came out on your break and you should have been having a break. And where most work experience would be sat down having a break, I was like researching diets for something. Or he said, I couldn't believe you were washing the bottom of a water bowl. And I was like, because you clean the whole thing. But, you know, like he says, like he noticed stuff that was all like positive stuff. He gave me some amazing projects, like training a kestrel and a creance to fly. I set up some like reptile care clubs, did some really cool stuff. And the vet for that rescue was also the vet for the first zoo that I ever worked in. And that's kind of how I fell like into zoos without ever really realizing that that's what I wanted to be in. And then it just basically just snowballed from that point. I started in a 4-hour contract at somewhere called the Bug World Experience, which doesn't exist anymore. It was on the Albert Dock in Liverpool, and it was just a bug zoo. That's all it was. It just exhibited bugs, but it was all inspired by somewhere in the US. So it was really like grand. And you know, you came into like a big curved cinema screen and watched a film first. There's like big animatronic praying mantises and like touch tables where you could catch pond dipping stuff. And that was my first ever zoo job. And that's where it just kind of like absolutely spiraled from there.
Firstly, I guess to start with, an amazing array of varied experience. You know, do you feel all of those skills that you picked up, whether it be from those variety of work experience roles through to the restaurant work, is it all transferable to today, to the role you're in?
Yes, because I guess every experience you have shapes the next one, doesn't it? So every decision you make, you're always reflecting on something you've done before, you've seen before, you've learned before, that hopefully you get better at every single time. And I think that's especially true when managing staff, especially as a young manager. Like I remember when I first took a manager role, I thought I very much had to do what I thought you were supposed to do as a manager. And that's not the approach I take anymore at all. It feels totally different from then to now.
Also, I you know, you've touched on it with that bug zoo. I'm sure you've heard many zookeepers come through, students, young keepers, or even ones which have been in it for a long time. And they say, I want to work with elephants. I want to work with great apes. I want to work with tigers. You know, almost earmarked exactly what their career is going to be from day one. From your experience, I mean, you've worked with an array of taxa, I'm sure, throughout them. But even with the bugs alone, what would you say to those people?
Oh, no, try everything. Absolutely. I remember when I worked in restaurants, I was like, I want to work in rescue. And it was always dogs and cats. And I don't think I could do it now, genuinely. I do foster dogs and cats now and I adopt. And I'm very heavily involved in bits and bobs there. But I don't think I could do it as a job. I think it would absolutely ruin me, like mentally. But the zoo stuff, a moment I started in that reptile sanctuary, I was like, I don't know what it was, something clicked. And I really felt like I understood everything he was saying. I was like, oh yeah, no, I understand that. Or I'd see something and I'd ask a question and he'd be like, yeah, that's right, because of that. I don't know. I just started working with him and thinking, God, I feel like these are the things that I was so badly wanting to know more and more and more and more. And it was like a bottomless pit, and it still is now with reptiles and inverts, just because they're so under-researched. And then when I went for the interview at Bug World, little did I know the vet had already said interviewer, like kind of thing. But I'd gone in being like, oh my God, I've only like, you know, I'd looked after a chili rose and I'd seen some hissing cockroaches and I'd seen some stick insects and I'd looked after live food, but nothing compared to like 46 species, including venomous, you know, which was very different. And when I went for my interview, I had to speak to the public, I had to handle some stuff. Even at that point, I was like, oh, bugs are really cool. Do you know what I mean? I think just that whole LVI group of animals, they're just so thought-provoking. You can do something every day where you're like, oh, why is it doing that? Whereas I think, I know you'd get that with other taxa, but they're so better researched, so you know so much more already. Whereas the LVI stuff, you still, you know, some things don't even have a species name yet, and you're working with them and thinking, uh-oh, I need to get this right, you know? But yeah, no, I fell in love with them. And I think I got a bit of a passion for trying to showcase them to other people as well and show how important they were, especially the general public who come into a bug house and go, you know, make these all these horrible noises. And you'd be like, would you go and do that outside a tiger enclosure? Or I was always fascinated that we would justify something like an invertebrate's existence because it's good for medicine or good for food or good for pollinating our food. We just don't do that with other animals, as in we don't say, oh, we must save the tiger because, you know, its tail might have a cure for cancer in 20 years. We just don't say it. We say we want to save them because they're beautiful. Do you know what I mean? And they're part of the forest and our landscape. But we just don't say that for invertebrates, even though they've been here forever, literally. But yeah, I got really passionate about that. And I think I still am passionate about it.
I guess all of that journey leads you to today, I guess. Did it feel a jump to your current position, or is it something which just slotted in?
So after Bugworld, I went to Reseath. You know, I did the same job here, basically, but different. It's still a college zoo, it's still licensed, it's still by ASA accredited. But when I started there, I started as an instructor keeper. And there, I think I had so much freedom within the first sort of 4 years that I don't even recognize it. Like now I recognize it in my team. And I'm like, oh, you should do that because that's good for your skills and your development. And you know, if you want to be a manager in the future, this is exactly the type of project you should be working on. But at the time I was never thinking that. I was just thinking, oh my God, this is a really cool native species project. We should totally rear 400 tiny baby spiders and, you know, never sleep. Do you know what I mean? And record this millions of data and be pootering tiny flies off feces from the thing. And everyone's like, oh God, it tastes like poo. Do you know what I mean? Like all these crazy things. I think I never did it because I was thinking, oh, in the future, these are skills that I want or because I want to manage. I just did them because I was totally excited to do them. And then I managed there for a little bit. And then I went to Paignton because as much as I love managing, because I feel like it gives me the opportunity to make the decision, because I feel like there's nothing more frustrating when you're on the ground and you're saying, oh God, I need this and I need that and the animals need this, but you can't get the support that you need for one reason or another because there's always restrictions and that's just the way it is. So I went back, but during managing, I felt like I was losing contact with the thing that I loved, which was animals. So that's when I went to work at Paignton Zoo and I felt like I got all that back again. So I took on the training, I took on the interns, because although I don't teach in this role, I'm very passionate about young people and them getting into that. The ones that are really passionate want to be there and in these jobs, giving them the opportunities that they need to get into them. So when I left Reseath and I was offered the role at Paignton, I said, yes, but please can I have the intern so I could still do a bit of that. And then I also took a job at the local college as well, fingers and pies, and see what's going on. And I had some amazing interns that are all in roles now in the animal industry and they're incredible. And then I did obviously a few years on the ground. And then I did the same thing. It's like, oh, but I want to be the one that's making the decisions and getting us there. And I feel like if I was in those boardrooms explaining it and justifying it and saying why we need it, and I am good at that. So then when this job came up, I was really excited when I met the management team that interviewed me. They were clearly on the same page. They were really passionate about it. They want us to be an industry leading zoological collection, but they want the students to have these opportunities. And I always do the same thing. I'm like, I want to go back to manager. I can still carve time out to be a keeper so I don't lose contact. The reality of it is that never really happens because you've always got so much to do. But you at least try and walk through things every now and again to see a lizard and be like, hi, I was a keeper once. So yeah, I moved backwards and forwards depending how you see it. But it's just the way I feel at the time. You know, if I really want to be back with it and I've missed it so much, then that's what I'll go and do. And if I feel like I've got the energy and the, you know, the drive to do the management stuff, because it is hard, you know, it's not an easy job at all. You can never make every decision that's right for everybody. You can just do the best you can with what you've got. But yeah, I might do this for a few years and then be like, oh no, I'd like to be a keeper again. I don't know. I'll see how it goes.
Truly amazing. What a journey. And obviously, as you say, so do you have to oversee, you know, the wildlife park, the companion animal side and everything? Is it all a package deal?
Yeah, it's a package deal. So we've got three main areas and they've got different focuses on different parts of our industry, if you like. So the wildlife park, its focus is very much on conservation, and that's its 5-year plan is fixed on that. And it's a really exciting plan, but it needs a lot of investment. But we've put a lot of investment in the last 3 years. So we're going in the right direction for that one. And for a small zoo, I think we do a pretty good job, you know, and I think all of my keepers are there for the right reasons and they want to get stuck in and do the projects for the right reasons. It's not to make money or, I mean, it is, it's got to stand on its own 2 feet, but that's not a driver for us. The driver is improving welfare and the conservation opportunities. And then the dog school for us is about business, because loads of our young people now don't want to work for the man. They want to work for themselves immediately from leaving college. So we want to be able to teach them those skills, because a lot of things can go wrong with running your own business as well. So that's what that's for. And then our companion animal department's about welfare and about doing research that enhances welfare for companion animals, because it's still, for example, rabbits, still the most neglected pet in the UK. How? When we've got so much science that supports them. So it's a huge, huge bandwidth. And we've recently taken on some commercial, like training, networking stuff. So we want to do some like skills academy type things where people are really coming in and homing in on those skills. It's not college level, you know, it's you're already doing the job, actually what's the next step for you kind of thing. So it's also what I like about the education sector. It's 100 miles an hour all of the time and it's never the same. So like you mix that with the zoos and the young people and everything else, it's just, it's crazy but fun.
sounds like you've got a great deal at your end, and as you say, only exciting times hopefully ahead. And I guess looking back rather than looking forwards, do you have any, it's very hard almost, but from that starting point to now, any advice you picked up along the way from your experiences, whether it be to your younger self or even someone listening, any little gems you've got along the way?
I don't know, things I kind of hope for my team is that passion and drive to do stuff on their own and not wait for someone to say, hey, there's this, you could do that. And obviously there's a huge part of support as a manager that you give so that they can do those things. But I want to see someone like biting at the bit to do that, or to see a problem and be like, oh, I wonder if I can fix that. As in like for animals, I just think conservation, there are so many species in need. And I think it's too easy to jump on a project that already exists. We lost something like 400 species of native invertebrates in the last, you know, couple of years. If every single person was like, no, I'm going to do something for that one bee species, rather than be worried about taking a step on a conservation project. I don't know, that's what I want to say, is people go, oh, there's a problem, I could definitely do something about that, and then take the initiative to do it and not worry so much if it goes too wrong. Well, what I feel I see in a lot of our young people these days, they're very worried about things not going right, rather than, I think when we were younger, things used to go wrong, but the whole world never knew about it. So maybe it wasn't that bad because there wasn't social media. So we maybe took more risks. But I think people need to take those risks, because that's how we learn as well. So yeah, take more risks, do more stuff, and then reflect on it, and then do better next time if it didn't go as you thought. Just be nicer to yourself, Jesus Christ.
Absolutely. Some cracking advice. And you've alluded to it, so making my life very easy. The building of a team, you know, you talk about what you kind of want from your own keepers and so on. The team is so central to any collection worldwide. It's the way, you know, it's the true powerhouse behind any true conservation education and so on. What is it, to delve a little bit deeper into the all-round aspects of a keeper? You know, you talked about a few of those aspects that you're looking for. What is it you're looking for when employing, when gathering your own keepers?
I'm looking for someone who's genuinely that passionate and driven. As lovely as it is to see the qualifications on someone's CV, because let's face it, that takes some dedication to do something for a number of years, because that's a number of years out of your lifetime. But there are tons of opportunities in your education that you could take up. And what I want to see is those, or since then. You don't even have to have done the education, it's just since then, what have you done? And I think everyone talks about volunteering, because I think lots of us did do that initially, and to be honest, lots of us still do that now in roles outside of the job that you do, that you're paid for, because you want to make something better, usually for a species or for welfare or for people. And it's just, it's that I want to see. And then when I take on here, I also look for people who are going to fit in the team. And I know that sounds strange, but the chemistry has to work, because they need to be a team that work together, and they need to be different. And I know that sounds strange as well, but they need to complement one another. Some, you know, I've got keepers who cannot stand looking at a computer. That's fair. But do you know what? They're darn good at getting a deep clean done, or do you know what I mean? Or like figuring out a puzzle outside, whereas I've got some that are absolutely wicked on Sims. Do you know what I mean? So they need to be able to complement one another, but look after each other as well. You know, like have some open communication. Like I need them to feel like in their teams, if there's a problem, they can go and speak to one another first. And then deal with it first together. And then, do you know what? If you really can't deal with it, then come to me. And then we'll try and deal with it together. But I'm very, very lucky here. I've got an amazing team that do all of those things plus more. You know, they literally, all of them come in every single day and absolutely smash it. And it's just a whole of a whirlwind here with students on top of everything else that they have to do. And they just do it every time without moaning. They're bloody brilliant. They really are.
Absolutely amazing. You know, you've alluded to it there with the, what have they done since the education, for example? You know, even since getting a job, I guess, is the same thing. Like you said, we continue to do things in our own time as keepers, as management and so on to further ourselves. Is there anything that little bit extra? You know, you've listed a few. You know, you even said Zims out there with that. But is there anything else from a gun license to tractor licenses to conferences to workshops? Is there anything in particular that people can home in on? For whatever level they are, really.
I think all those things are nice. Like if I saw them on a CV, I'd be like, as in great. But realistically, if they needed something tickety and they were the right person, I would put that in place. It would never be something that I'd balance as yes or no. It very much to me comes to the interview day when you speak to them and you meet them and you know if they're the right one or not the right one for your team and what you're the same energy, do you know what I mean, as everyone else that you're working with. So yeah, they're all definitely nice to have, but they're not deal breakers for me. No,
absolutely. Now we're going to head into the big questions as part of this episode where we tackle some of the larger questions throughout the industry and try to get to a bottom of a few as we go. The first one's, it's quite a relevant one to the modern day. You know, throughout our zoos, there are certain species which are very much under the spotlight. You know, we've had orca most recently with the phasing out of them through their breeding programs in the long term as a whole throughout our collections. Obviously, this continues through elephant, big cats, gorillas. You know, the list is endless of where it could stop. So the question alongside this is, with our zoos continuing to strive to be better, to do better, and to show that all the good that we are already doing, I think that's a big part of it. Can we achieve the high levels of these species, or unfortunately, is it going to end the same way as what appears to be the case with the orca?
All the big things tend to be mammals. I'm definitely not a mammal specialist at all. I don't think anything's impossible. It all depends on resources, doesn't it? You can build some absolutely incredible enclosures for some of those bigger animals. It's whether it stretches to the resources. And I think, and this is the thing I think I always struggle with, expectations of people. Zoos obviously vary massively from small to huge. And those bigger zoos have a lot more capital to do something with. And I think there's a risk with expectations. You can only put in what you can make, do you know what I mean? So there's a limit every single time, but there are some incredible enclosures that you could do, whether that's the right thing or not, or if that would still give you your public what they would need so you could still make the money to continue to reinvest, of course, is questionable. Yeah, no, I don't know how to answer that one, to be honest. I don't think we can do anything right. Even if we removed all those big animals from zoos and just did small ones, they'd find something else. And there'd be something else. You know, it's all over the animal industry. You look at private keepers of reptiles and they're targeted continuously. That's, you know, very difficult. And they don't have the backing that zoos have with social media and, you know, the network and stuff to help back themselves up. I don't think there's an end to it. You could get rid of all the big stuff and there'd still be something else. I'm not saying that those things are right or wrong. Every single case is different. You can look at an animal in one place and then an animal in another place and they'd have a totally different experience, regardless of whether their enclosure is the same or not, because it depends where they've come from. I don't know, it's really hard to do. It's hard to do anything on a blanket-based thing for animals because they're all different.
You've opened up the can of worms as well, and it's very interesting, actually. The, you know, you're right, it's all the big animals. It's all predominantly, they're mainly mammals that we're looking at, because as a human, I guess we engage more with our mammals because we can see emotion better than a reptile or an invert or so on. Like you're saying, though, it doesn't mean that the game will always be that way. So, you know, you've got your Komodos, you've got your crocodile, and then your big reptiles, which I'm sure are very much in the game in the long term if it were to go that way.
Yeah, but I do think as zoos, we need to be in front of it every single time. you know, and even if there's a little niggle that you know something's not quite right for that animal, then we should be doing it first before anyone else picks us apart on it. I don't think we've been as good at that as an industry. I think sometimes we've been a little bit reactive with some of that. But I think we've learned from that now. And that's why all those positive stories come out way before any of the other stuff. But I just think there's some things we know. We know that snakes need bigger enclosures with lots of enrichment. And that's not been questionable for the last 20 years as a keeper. But obviously the legislation has never been reflective of that. And it's only now things have started to come out to say that it must be its body length plus a bit more. You think, did we really have to get to a point where we had to put in sizes of the snake's body length and a bit more? I just feel like we shouldn't have issues now where, I'm not saying this is, you know, this is across the animal industry as a whole, we should never have got to a point where someone's gone, oh no, you need to do this, and then we've gone, oh yeah, we kind of knew that, we should have done that. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know that, so just do it first before someone does something bad, then you've got to react to it anyway. Do everything for the right reasons in the first place, and then hopefully that doesn't matter, does it, in the long run?
Totally. And I think, like you say, we are slowly getting there and we are moving forwards on this matter. So we'll see what the future holds for sure with that one. Well, I can let you know, you've happily answered that question. Yeah, you've given, that's a very good answer. The next one, though, is a little different, but very much something which is part of every keeper's lives, and it's always on the agenda, is the balancing life with a career. Is it possible? Is it not? You know, whether it be a mortgage, starting a family, through to simply just finances as a whole, is it unfortunately picking one or the other, or can the balance be made?
I think the balance can be made depending on where you work, I guess. But I think about all the stuff that I've done over the years is not because anyone's expected it of me. I've done it because I've desperately wanted to do it myself or for the animals I've cared for. And I guess maybe that's not the right thing, you know, coming into the zoo late at night to finish building a monkey enclosure or painting the walls or getting the vivs ready so that the animals can get in. You know, I've done so many nights where I've been there till like 10, 11 o'clock at night, or stayed till stupid o'clock because we've got a new animal and you want to make sure it settles in okay. I know none of these things, no manager's ever asked me to do. I've just done because I've wanted to. And to be honest, my manager now, you know, she's hugely supportive and level-headed, but she works crazy hard. But she would never say to me, Lauren, you've got to. Do you know what I mean? And even now she'll say, but have you taken your holidays? Because I manage my own stuff like that. And sometimes I don't always take them, but that's not her fault. That's me. That's literally me. I could have done it, but I didn't because I was so desperately wanted to do something else. But that's just because I wanted to. And I think that's, for me, I think that's nice that I've got a job that I actually want to do in my time off instead of one that I don't want to do but have to do anyway. Look at my sister that does, she does some accounts stuff in America. It sounds very boring, but you know, she does tons of overtime. Yeah, she gets paid for it, but my god, it looks miserable. Do you know what I mean? I think, well, no, I'm not being paid for it, but you know what, I'm still getting somewhere with everything that I wanted to do, and I'm dead happy when that animal comes in or something goes right. I think you can have a balance, you do, but that's up to you to set that. I don't think any employer can tell you that you have to do something. First and foremost, it needs to be you making that call. But equally, all those extra things, my god, some of the opportunities, some of the cool stuff that I've done because I've said yes to so much stuff over the years, and I'd hate to have never have done those things, even though I was shattered and tired and stressed and everything else, but I still wouldn't have changed any of it. Still have gone and done it all over again. I was taking students Natterjack toad surveying, and they were so engrossed in it, and we were there till very late, and we got back at 1 o'clock in the morning, and we were not supposed to be back that late, and all the parents were there, and I was like, oh my god, I'm gonna be in so much trouble. And but the kids, honestly, the students were just elated because they found something like 56 Natterjack toads, sexed them, weighed them, all that went to the, was part of a conservation project, and they loved it. Not once did I think, oh god, but I should have been at home, you know, doing what would I have done at home? Absolutely nothing. I had a great time. So yeah, I wouldn't change any of it. I've done some amazing stuff.
It goes back to, you know, the stuff we do, it is priceless, and money can't buy that sort of stuff, very much so. No, very well, that's number two complete. You're on that final one now. This is very much going from more of a personal one up to a collection wide one. It's collection planning. Obviously, we all know that it doesn't matter if you're a wildlife park, safari park, zoo, college, no matter what you are, a collection plan is essential to move forwards and to thrive. With regards to your own, you know, how is it unique? And it's always a tricky question, but looking back, is there anything maybe you would look to improve or have changed?
Ours is, I guess, unique in the way that, because we are basically a resource, that services multiple curriculum areas. So yes, we are a wildlife park, which is separate and stands on its own, but we're also servicing FE curriculum, HE curriculum, vet nurse curriculum, level one curriculum, inclusive learning curriculum. Do you know what I mean? And we opened our doors to arboriculture, farm. We are literally there for everybody. And also we've got a horticulture department we're desperate to have more of a partnership with as well. And so we have a representative from each of those teams that are invited to the collection plan meeting, where we review the species and discuss new ones. And that's the easiest, I say easiest, it's a lot, they're so long, but we basically talk about what we've got, why we've got it, what its value is in conservation education research and from a practical point of view, and then what we're doing with it in the future, and how we justify that. And each of the people that come usually have an interest in the taxa, so we split it between taxa. It feels like a I want because thing, because that's something they're passionate about or something they've worked with before, but it doesn't mean it necessarily fits into what we're doing or our five-year plan. So sometimes I feel like I'm just like, I don't know, like I just chair everything. I don't even get a say in anything, to be honest. I'm the manager, but never even get to pick anything good. But we do, you know, there is some leeway for stuff like that, because I believe that my keepers especially should be working with stuff that they're passionate about, even if it sits outside of some of those boxes, because that's their passion and their development. So we have got elements of that where we can support it, but generally it got to fit those three boxes in one way or another. And then not just that, can we afford what it needs to do it well as well? It can't be we could have it, but it would be in something not as nice as we'd like. We need to, if we're going to do it, we need to do it properly for the reason we said that we would have it for. So that's how we do it here. And yeah, no, I don't get to pick anything good. I've just realized that by explaining that I don't get to. How disappointing.
Amazing. If I were to put you on the spot, is there a certain species which you particularly like throughout the collection? There's always, whether it be an individual or a species, there's always one which captures the attention.
So here we've got rhino iguanas, and I love those because I've always wanted to work with them, but never worked anywhere where we could have them. I've worked with other iguana species, absolutely love them. We had these from hatchlings, so watching them grow has been amazing because they're beautiful. I mean, me personally, because it's a common kind of job interview question you get, isn't it? Is if you could bring any animal into the collection, what would you bring? And I always say something that they expect me to say with a conservation value and project and blah, blah, blah. But realistically, what I would have is tons of Asian rat snakes and loads of leggy spiders. That is what I would have, because Asian rat snakes are just wicked. And honestly, if I won the lottery, that's probably what I'd have at home as well, is like a wicked collection of Asian rat snakes, because they're fast, they're beautiful, they're smart, you know, and they like make you think, you have to think on your feet, because otherwise they run rings around you. But that's what I'd have, but they're just not appropriate for where we are now. No. And it just wouldn't fit. But that, if I could pick anything, that's what I'd have.
Yeah, the dream's there. The dream's there indeed. Okay, well, that's a nice way. That brings us to the end of the big questions. You've survived, you got through. We're now on to the quickfire round. It's the last part of this episode where we tackle some of the simpler questions. It should be quickfire, but keepers love to talk, so I need to rename it, because it doesn't always go as quick as it should. So let's get going. Number one, it's a simple one, but a hard one. What's your favourite animal?
A dog. I don't even go wrong with a dog.
Any certain breed?
Lurchers, every time, yeah.
Good choice. Good choice. Okay, the next one then. What is the best side of the industry that we work in?
I think everyone says this. It is the people. Like, I went to a conference yesterday, and as nice as the conference was, really, it was just to see people. It's the people that you only see at these conferences, you know, and you can just literally geek out for a full few days on, like, the stuff that you really love. So, yeah, no, I love that.
Absolutely. Well, the next one for you is very relevant in the modern day, and that is, what is your top tip for mental health and well-being?
Just be nice to yourself. Stuff goes wrong. It's not that bad. It's fine.
Really, really nice little bit of advice there. Okay, so to reflect a previous question, what do you still feel we need to improve within the industry?
I think similar to what you were saying before, we probably need to just say more about the good stuff. And I think it's not bad that we recognise all the bad things all the time, because actually it makes us improve on stuff. But we're bloody terrible at saying that something's gone well, even if it was little, and we should probably do that way more than we do. And I'm exactly the same. I do something and then I'm like, right, next, we've got the next job to do, instead of standing back and going, ah, that's really good, that. Well done us. Do you know what I mean? It's something I really try to do a bit more of, but terrible at.
Yeah, very much so. And this, the next question goes exactly into a bit more of a personal side, I guess. What's your favourite moment of your career so far?
Oh God, my career. I'm dead proud that I've ever even made it into the career. that I thought I was never, ever going to make it into. And then the proudest thing I've ever done, it's another interview question, isn't it, that you get asked. And I always pull out these booklets and slap them on the desk. And I was very fortunate about 6 years to run a herpetological and entomological society where I used to work. And those students were the students that were always going to make it. And I put all of my time and effort into them alongside of my role. And they are probably still my proudest thing, because I still see them all now. And they're all absolutely excelling everywhere. But they were all doing stuff. They were doing stuff in their own time with their own money to further their learning. And I loved. And they're always like, oh, thank you so much for taking us there. And I'd be like, you have no idea how nerdy this was for me. And I loved it as well. You know, it wasn't like I'm only doing it because I've got to take you on a trip. It was like, I'm totally going on the trip because I also want to go on the trip. But yeah, no, they were absolutely brilliant. And to see them all now, you know, I've employed some of them now as well. You know, I've seen them throughout the years and they're great. Yeah, I loved that.
It's great. It's really, really nice to hear your passion for helping others. I think that's something which is coming up a lot throughout this episode, hearing the passing of knowledge, the passing of the baton, as it were, throughout your knowledge as well. Really, really nice.
It's opportunities, though. It's not that people can't do it. It's that they're not given the opportunities. And that's why I like the jobs in the college zoos, because I could do that on a bigger scale. Then it was great at painting that I had the interns, but you know, that was 2 a year and that was great. But it just, I feel like I can do more of that here in this role.
Absolutely. Really, really great. Now, the next question I've got for you could take you anywhere in the globe. And that is, what zoo would you like to visit globally and why?
In America, there's lots of little teaching zoos, but they're just ran differently to how our like colleges and stuff are run here. And I'd be dead interested to see some of those. To be honest, I go to zoos all the time, but I never even see the animals. I'm just sat in meeting rooms. I never even get to go and look at the good stuff. But I've seen, I don't know, it's not something where I think, oh, I really must go and see those zoos. I'd love to see Australia Zoo, maybe. I'm more interested in those like smaller little niche ones that kind of sit out the way. And they're doing these like really cool stuff, but no one knows about them. And they're the ones, but the problem is because no one knows about them, you never know where you want to visit, but you just find them, don't you? But they're the ones I'd like to see. And then, some of the like more novel kind of like teaching zoo things I'd be interested to see in America.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, I now need you to put on your mystic hat, and that's because I need you to look into the future. In 20 to 30 years, do you see zoos being different to today, or are they going to be the same?
I think there'll be some the same, but I think the pressures are going to be harder and harder. The more that we have people against us, and I think sometimes we're our own worst enemy as well, because we're always trying to improve, but we make those guidelines we have to work in so much harder every single time. And I don't think that what you can expect from one zoo is the same of another one. And I think it's going to get harder for smaller zoos because the capital's just not there. And I think that's what people forget, is all the extra stuff is definitely good. It's not that people don't want to do it, but actually smaller zoos need to manage it in a different way, because they're never going to make the investment the bigger zoos would make to be able to put that back in terms of staff and infrastructure. It doesn't mean that they're not doing a good job or working with those guidelines. They just can't evidence it the same as some of the other ones. So I think it's going to get harder for the smaller ones. But I think in that short amount of time, probably still look fairly similar. Nothing moves fast enough, does it?
Definitely not. Well, you're doing very well. We're on that second to last question of the whole episode, and that's very personal, and that's within the industry. Who's your idol?
See, I looked at this question and I was worried. Mine's probably not in the industry as such. There are people I watch do talks and things and I'm like, oh my God, I'd love to be able to stand up and talk like that, or the opportunity to work on some of those projects. And when I meet especially people in the field that are in the conservation projects, and they're like knee deep in like trenches, trudging through rainforest, and they're wet all of the time, but they're still out there looking for that turtle. Or do you know what I mean? Like they all really inspire me. But for me, I would not be anywhere today if it wasn't for Gary and Jane that ran that reptile and raptor rescue that I started in. So it's not the zoo industry, but it's still the animal industry. But they gave me those opportunities that I now try and give to everybody else, because I would just never have got them. I didn't drive. I had no money. Would never have been able to have done any of that stuff. And they were literally like, hey, we've got a friend at Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. Go and see them. Hey, we've got a friend who's an exotic vet. Go and see them. Hey, we've got a friend at the RSPCA. Go and see them. And they shoved me in front of all of these people. And I learned so much so quickly. And I met so many amazing people that just paved my my career. So without them, I'd be absolutely screwed. But it was all because of that one talk that I saw from Gary and his absolute passion for rescuing reptiles and birds of prey.
Those are really, really lovely words. And thank you so much for sharing those. Now, we're on that final question. We're nearly there. I now need you to describe the whole industry that we work in only three words.
Passion, because it all comes from people's passion. It literally wouldn't happen without individual people being absolutely driven to help something. We would just be exhibits and zoos for entertainment. We wouldn't be anything else. It's all individual people that fall in love with something and then want to do something about it. So I guess the next one is then people, because it doesn't exist, does it, without the people? And then it sounds dead cheesy, but like connections or network or something, because it always amazes me when you go somewhere, everyone knows everyone, everyone knew someone. Do you know what I mean? You know someone else. And because everyone, I think, works together and knows each other, that things start to kind of take shape and happen. And I think all that's super important. I don't think we'd be what we are without it.
Really nice way to sum it up and bring us to a close. I cannot stress. Thank you so much for coming on, sharing with us all your stories, your words, wisdoms, and your overall journey along the way. It's been a real, real pleasure. And for myself and the listeners, thank you.
Okay. No, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
We'll get you on again very soon. But until next time, do take care of yourself.
Thank you, James.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that concludes this week's episode. What an amazing guest and an amazing time we had. Now, if you have enjoyed it, please do subscribe on Instagram, Facebook, or our podcast channels to Zookeeping 101. I can't express how thankful I am personally from a fellow zookeeper to have you along for this quite amazing journey, learning about everything zookeeper. Otherwise, please subscribe. Thank you for listening and see you very, very soon. Bye.